This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Stephanie Elizondo Greist has lived a nomadic life for decades. She traveled here and abroad, writing stories about people and their shared histories. Her voyages often center on borders, both cultural and physical. It's a theme Stephanie knows well. She grew up with two identities. Her father's a white man from Kansas, her mother a Chicana, or Mexican-American. And as a child, she found out that embracing her Chicana side meant seeing doors of opportunity close. Stephanie later spent decades rediscovering and reasserting her Chicana identity. Today, she's a writer and a professor of creative nonfiction at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her newest book is called All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. And she is staying put long enough for her to talk with us today. Stephanie, welcome. Good to have you here.
It's such an honor to be here, Frank. Thank you.
You still have family and friends in South Texas, in Southern Texas. Tell us more about what's going on there, because I know you're concerned.
It has been quite a nightmare, actually. I'm very lucky to have a wonderful sister in San Antonio who rescued my parents out of harm's way on Thursday night. Friday, Rockport and Port Aransas, wonderful communities that are just 20 minutes away from my hometown, were almost wiped off the map. And then all attention turned to Houston, Texas. All weekend, I've been texting with friends who are writing to me from inside of their closets, who are writing to me while their homes are being flooded. I mean, it's utterly terrifying.
Yeah, well, but as far as you know, most of the folks...
Yes, all of my loved ones are accounted for except for one cousin in Houston.
All right. Well, keep our thoughts with you and, everybody during this storm as it continues. You tell us about your family's history or that part of the family that is from that part of the world.
Yes. So my family, all my uncles are cowboys, as I like to say. over 100 years of my family are vaqueros, which is Spanish for cowboys, and we work on the King Ranch of South Texas. Now, the King Ranch is just legendary. King Ranch is 850,000 acres. That is bigger than Dubai.
It is
a lot of cows. It's bigger than Rhode Island, this massive piece of land. And it was founded by Richard King, who is a ship captain from New York, and in 1850 traveled down to South Texas and saw all the land, all the opportunity, traveled to a little village in Mexico, in Tamaulipas, and my great-great-grandfather, Juan de Dios Silva, was among them, and invited them to come up and work on his ranch in Texas, and they all did. This was right as the Mexican border had just formed officially, and they worked there ever since. So I have a long, long, long history in South Texas.
And, of course, a lot of the people in South Texas who will claim Mexican ancestry will say that they've been there longer than the Texans, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a saying, we didn't cross the border crossed us. It crossed right over our head, and that's had major ramifications, which is something I write quite a lot about.
We'll talk more about that, because growing up, and maybe you can tell us about your parents, too, what your mom did and what your dad did and where he was from, and how you came to live in that part of the world.
Yes. So I am the product of wanderlust, certainly from my great-great-great-grandfather, Juan de Dios Silva, who traveled up from Mexico into what was then considered Texas. And then on my father's side, my great-great-uncle Jake was a hobo who saw all of America with his legs dangling over the edge of a freight train. And my father inherited that wanderlust. He was a drummer for the U.S. Navy Band. And once he had a gig in Corpus Christi, and a very pretty young woman was sitting in the audience. He walked up and very smoothly spilled a Coke all over her shoes when he introduced himself. They were married 3 months later. And so, and they actually left to the Northeast for a few years. I was actually born in Maryland, but got to Texas as quick as I could. And yeah, so I had my childhood. I grew up in Corpus Christi, which was at one point thought to be a direct hit by the hurricane, but thankfully it turned just a little bit away so that we mostly have down trees, down power lines, but no major flooding damage.
So tell us more about your mom and your dad. What do they do?
Yes. So my mother, in the late 70s, my mother became a high power executive at IBM. And my dad, who had at that point retired from the Navy, was a stay-at-home dad and stayed home and raised my sis and me. And so I grew up with these really interesting role models of a woman, a very strong businesswoman, and a father who was an artist, was a musician, was a jazz drummer.
So there's one contrast. Your mother also Tejana or Chicana,
yes.
Mexican-American, Tejana as they would say in Texas. How much of that did she impart to you?
Well, That's a really complicated subject, actually. It's taken me 3 books to work through that, actually. The reality is that even though Texas was Mexico for much of its history, Tejanos were treated really quite poorly, especially in the era my mother grew up. In fact, in the 50s, there was a school district not far from where my mother was attending school where all Mexican-American children were required to take first grade 3 times. There was beginner,
just a requirement,
middle,
not
just a requirement.
No testing. Just...
No testing. Everyone had to take. Yes. So as a result, many dropped out. Otherwise, you would graduate when you were like 20.
Yeah.
And so students were punished for speaking Spanish. People were punished for having Spanish accents. And when my mother, during my mother's era, going to school, teachers would rap on your knuckles with a ruler for speaking Spanish. Teachers would actually shove bars of soap into students' mouths. So that sort of trauma resulted in very few parents teaching their children Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so my generation lost the language. And studies show that this is something that happens all throughout the Southwest. Only like 17% of third generation Mexican Americans even still speak the language. And so this became quite clear to me. My introduction to the tensions in my city occurred when I was in third grade, and it was decided that our class had too many students, and so one day the teacher said she needed to divide us into two. And one by one, she began to send all the white kids to one side of the room and all the brown kids to the other side of the room. And I was the last person, and she looked down at me over the rims of her glasses, and she said, "What are you, Stephanie? Are you Hispanic or are you white?" And I didn't know what to say because my mother was one and my father was the other. Did that make me both? Did that make me neither? Did that make me either? And so I looked over at the white kids, saw who was over there, and then I looked over at the brown kids, and then I saw, oh, my best friend's there, Melida. And so I ran over to that side of the room. And then we were dismissed, went to a different room with a different teacher. And she passed around a book and asked us each to read aloud. And so I was with students who I didn't appreciate at the moment, but these are very intelligent students that spoke two languages, not just one. Mm. They were completely fluent in English and in Spanish. And rather than being rewarded for that, they were punished for the fact that their reading ability in English was a bit limited. And my heart began to pound in that moment, listening to my colleagues read, my classmates read. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm not in the right class. And so when I got the book, I sat up straight and I read each word loud and clear. And when class ended, I went up to the teacher and I said, "I want to be where the other kids are." And she agreed. And so from that point forward, whenever I was asked, I always said I was white.
Did you look back at any particular point? Because, again, you said one of your best friends was in that other class. Did you have – at that moment, you're a third grader and you just want mm-hmm. to be with somebody who can read like you do. But were there moments along the way in elementary school where you looked at that and thought – where did this division come from? Were you conscious of?
Well, I don't know if I was really so. I don't know how well I understood why this was happening, but I saw the result, which is these students went to an ESL class, even though many of them did not need to be. I mean, ESL is a wonderful thing, but if one doesn't need to be in that class, it can be they can be held a bit behind, and that was certainly the case. I mean, all the students that I progressed with, we all wound up in the honors AP class when we got to high school, and the students that stayed in the other class did not. Yeah. So it was a pretty major separation that occurred at us quite young.
Did you talk about that at home at all? Did you go home and say, you know, "Mom, Dad, what should I say the next time they ask me that?"
You know, I don't know if I ever the conversations that I recall came much later when I was in high school.
Yeah. So and the other you had an older sister as well.
I did, yes.
All right. So what was your relationship with her?
Oh, my big sister was just my hero. And I think I take many, many qualities from her. She experimented in vegetarianism, so of course I became a vegetarian. She was on the dance team in high school, the Mary Carroll High School Tigerettes. So I followed along, put on a pair of sequined cowboy boots and a cowboy hat and went out and did Rockette-style dancing across the football field. Yes.
Did your mother and father ever give you advice on sort of how to present yourself? I mean, again, you sort of talked about your mother being traumatized, so clearly she doesn't want to pass on that tradition if it's going to mean trouble for you, right? Mm-hmm. It was trouble for her, so mm-hmm. clearly I'm not going to do that for my child. And you can understand the thinking there. Were there lessons overt to avoid this, watch for that, do more of this, don't ever do that? that would be sort of cultural markers and warnings about cultural markers?
Well, I feel like I was really raised in very much in my dad's culture. You know, he was the jazz musician, so we listened to Frank Sinatra. I grew up listening to that instead of Pedro Infante. My mother grew up from a very young age, had to cook for a family of eight, and became a bit resentful of that. And as soon as she got married, she told my dad, you know, I'm going to cook for you once a meal, you know, once a year, one meal a year, Buster, that's about it. And so we got lasagna every Christmas. So I didn't grow up with the kinds of foods that are typically associated with a Chicano childhood. So those sorts of cultural lessons I received more when I went to our family's larger extended family's house.
And you've also, and speaking of that, you've talked about the difference between your relationship with your grandmother and your abuela.
Yes, I have. Yeah, so my grandmother was that would be my father's mother. We were tremendously close. We would go drive out and visit her every summer in Kansas, and she's actually the person I think I can credit with first starting my my writing life. I missed her tremendously. As soon as we would pull away, the van would pull away from her home in Kansas, Minneapolis, Kansas, and so I would write to her every thought, every exciting experience that happened to me, I would capture in prose form and send to her. So we had this correspondence that lasted until her death when she was 17. My abuela, unfortunately, I didn't get to know her, and neither really did my mother, because my mother's mother actually committed suicide when she was 25 years old and had five children.
We'll pursue this conversation when I continue talking with Stephanie Elizondo Greist. She's an award-winning writer. Her newest book is All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. We'll find out more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, spending the hour with Stephanie Elizondo Greist, an award-winning writer whose work focuses on borderlands and the people who inhabit them. She's a professor of creative nonfiction at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the author of many books. We're talking about your relationship with your grandmother from Kansas and then your abuela, who you didn't know as well. Was it something, I mean, did you think about the differences in those families and kind of where, you know, or and the fact that you didn't have a relationship? Was that something you kind of took for granted as a girl?
I definitely grew up identifying far more with my father's side of the family. We drove there every summer, and so I really spent a good quality 1 to 2 weeks with them every year. And those are really formative years of my life. My mother's family was a bit more of a mystery, in part because they spoke Spanish, and that was a language that I did not speak myself. And so language was always the language of secrets, of jokes that I wasn't in on. And I actually, to the point where I maybe had a bit of resentment about the language, because life just seemed so much more fun in Spanish. People laughed harder. And Spanish was the language of celebration. It was a language of birthdays, of quinceañeras, of weddings, of Easter celebrations, of piñatas. So it seemed like a lot of fun, but I didn't feel a part of it because I couldn't communicate.
You talked about your experiences in elementary school. What about high school then? What were you doing in high school?
In high school, well, high school is actually what shifted my relationship with cultural identity in a pretty stark way. I was quite obsessed with the idea of going to college at a very young age, and really, really worked quite hard throughout junior high and high school to try to make that happen. And this was pre-internet, so I spent all of my afternoons in the guidance counselor's office going through the file bin, looking for scholarships, looking for ways to take myself to college. And I was there so often that a guidance counselor took interest in me. And she called me into her office one day and asked me the same question that I'd been asked many years earlier. What are you, Stephanie? Are you Hispanic or are you white? And before I could speak, she gave me a hint of what I should say. And that was, your SAT scores are not high enough to apply for some of these scholarships. If you're considered white, if you're considered Hispanic, that may change for you. That was a shocking thing to be told, but it seemed clear what my answer should be. And so she literally got a bottle of Whiteout, and she whited out, and she whited out the W,
wow,
and put an H on it. And it seemed like a simple thing at the time. I mean, see, it was significant, but it seemed simple. And then she's like, "Okay, go about your business." And I was like, "Okay," but now that I was registered as a different way, I suddenly was eligible to apply for many scholarships. I applied for all of them, and I got them. I wound up at UT Austin on a completely full ride, which was so thrilling, until I began to meet the other scholarship recipients. And that's when I was hit by this tsunami of guilt that has really never subsided, which is I began to realize that all of the other young students there had really suffered a lot for being Latino. And they had faced discrimination. Some of them were migrant farm workers. I mean, I encountered students at all the little scholarship reunions we would have who grew up traveling around the country picking sugar beets. I mean, they had such a radically different life, and I began to feel like a total fraud. And to the point where I actually called my mom once crying and saying, I think I should give back my scholarships. I don't deserve this. And she's like, what do you mean you don't deserve this? Like, I suffered, you know? You're a mother, you know? I mean, it's all of our family. I was the one who had these opportunities. Yeah. And she sort of encouraged me to see myself as a pioneer for our family. And, you know, I was the first generation to go to college in my family. That meant a lot. And so I said, okay, I will stay here. But then I thought, well, I still have to do something larger for my community. And unfortunately, I don't have talents like medicine or law or things that maybe would be a bit more, perhaps a bit more useful. But I had always gravitated toward stories. I'd always gravitated toward the written word. And so I decided, well, if that's what I'm going to do, I'm going to turn my focus and write about my community.
And you took a Chicano studies course as well.
I did, yes, which was critical to my own identity formation. Okay. When I was at UT Austin, I took a number of classes on Chicano politics, Mexican-American studies, the history of Mexicans in Texas. And those were completely energizing and affirming.
Well, I want to talk more about that. I want to get back to something you said about your mother's reaction. I mean, on the one hand, we can understand, too, a mother saying, I know, you're not throwing this away.
Yeah.
but the idea that you may owe something to, or this may be important to her community, did that surprise you? Because it feels to me, like the little bit we've talked, that she wasn't talking much about that community or the need to come back and serve. Was that the first you'd heard that maybe you'd had a responsibility and this could be a chance to do something for a community?
Perhaps so. Yeah, that was really an illuminating and energizing moment. And then I just began to think about all of the family that we have and how we had ultimately been treated by the King Ranch. You know, for the King Ranch had treated us incredibly well for like over a century. And then in the 1980s, the board of the King Ranch was slowly taken over by Harvard businessmen who decided that or realized that one helicopter could do the same amount of work in a couple of hours with cows that would take cowboys weeks and weeks and weeks. So they fired their cowboys who had up until then lived cradle to grave protection and instead invested in a helicopter and some pilots. Yeah. And so all of our vaquero relatives retreated off the ranch. And to this day, we only have a couple of people still working on the ranch, whereas before all of us lived on the ranch. All of our elders are still buried there on the ranch.
And of course, the interesting thing was that ranch was profitable, just not
immensely
profitable
enough. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was the 1980s.
Yes.
It hasn't stopped. Mm-hmm. But tell me more, though, about what you learned in those classes and what that did for you, how that transformed your thinking about your own identity.
Well, it certainly gave me pride. I think the only thing that I'd really learned about Mexicans prior to taking those classes was that we murdered Davy Crockett at the Alamo. And so actually realizing all of the beauty of the culture and learning about the Mayans and learn, you know, before I think my only knowledge of Aztecs was that they committed human sacrifice and then actually learning about these incredibly deeply sophisticated cultures. Right around this time, I wanted to start traveling to Mexico. My mother and I made this incredible trip when I was in college to Mexico, and we traveled to all throughout the city. We went to Frida Kahlo's Casa de Azul. We went to the Anthropology Museum, and I just began to realize, like, I descend from a really extraordinary people, and it's time to honor that, to pay homage to that, and to write about that.
You went to a conference with a well-known journalist at the time, and that also started you. Tell us more about
that. Yes. Okay. So, yes. So that is – so the story I've just been telling is sort of like the larger, broader story. But there was an interlude, which is while my wanderlust was raging, when I was a senior in high school, I got an invitation to a journalism convention in Washington, D.C., and was able to raise money to go out there. And raising money was difficult. And actually, now that I think about it, the people who funded this trip to go were a group of Latino lawyers in town in Corpus Christi. So always be very appreciative of that. And it took some fundraising, so it was not easy to go to this conference. I had to work to go to the conference. And anyway, so when I arrived there, my eyes are wide open. I am completely open. I am ready to receive information from the universe that brought me to this conference. And it happened the very first night. So opening keynote was by Charles Beerbauer. He was a political correspondent for CNN. This was in the spring of 1992. So man had seen the collapse of the Berlin Wall. He'd seen the fall of the Soviet Union. He'd seen riots and revolution and coup d'etat. And the entire time he's talking, I'm thinking, I want to go where that man has been. And when he was done, he asked for questions. And I raised my hand and I ran to the front of the room and I said, I want to be you. What do I do? And he said, learn Russian. Next question. And I said, okay. I can't even talk to my abuelita. Like, how could I possibly learn a language like Russian? And why would I even want to? This was, you know, in 1992, again, the Soviet Union had just collapsed. I only knew it as the evil empire. Yeah. Yet I was, being 18, I was old enough to recognize it's not very often in life that you get truly specific advice. And learn Russian is a difficult advice, but it is specific. Yeah. You can take a class.
Right.
So that's what I did. So when I arrived to UT Austin, I enrolled in Russian 601A and studied it for 4 years. And then in January 96, never having seen snow fall from the sky in my life, I jetted off to Moscow.
Tell us about that trip.
Moscow at that time was insane. It was 5 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Chechen War was raging. Ruble was falling. Mafia had infiltrated every aspect of that nation. And I was in the middle of it with a pad and pen, just wondering, you know, what to do, what to do, what to do. And it quickly, the answer quickly came. It was obvious that I quickly realized I'm basically taking up space in the subway here. This was a difficult time in the country. And so trying to find a way to justify my time there and justify my space, justify the air I was breathing and occupying, came to me when one night I was walking home from the subway. It was very, very, very cold, very cold night. And I was at a train station and I noticed there were children sleeping beneath the train tracks, which was really shocking. That's not something that I had ever seen. And I began to do some research and found that there are over 1 million homeless youth in Russia at that time. Many of them were not even orphans, but their parents had just come upon really hard times and taken to the bottle, and the kids just sort of went feral. And I found a children's shelter. So taking the problem from 1 million down to the 40 children that were at this particular shelter and began working with them. And again, realizing that there was not a lot I could do myself, but perhaps I could write about it, and maybe writing about it would, you know, some benefactor might read about it and decide to do something. And so that sort of became my way about being an activist, being working towards social justice, was just to bear witness to something, to ask a lot of questions, take notes, and then do this in the hope of service of someone else.
It'd be interesting to pause here on this journey and at this moment, because we've got all of these currents running through this newfound understanding and appreciation of your Chicano culture, a desire to learn more about it and write about it, the wanderlust that perhaps you inherited from your father's side of the family. You want to get out there and go to these far-flung corners of the globe. You're writing now not about things that have to do with the borderlands and your culture, but about exotic cultures, exotic from the point of view of an American. Was this what you thought you would be doing, foreign correspondent?
Yeah, well, that was the goal. When I went to Moscow, I went with the intention, the hope, the desire to become a foreign correspondent. But what I found ultimately, Frank, was that I continue to think about home. Mm. And this was brought very starkly to me when I began to travel, when I left Russia and began traveling into the former Soviet satellites, so Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And then later, after my year in Russia, I became a Henry Luce scholar and went to China for a year. And I began to realize one of the tragedies of totalitarianism was its attempt to vanquish, wipe out indigenous culture. So when I was in Lithuania, for example, I met a gentleman who was in his 60s who had spent most of his 20s in prison being tortured on a ritual basis because he refused to renounce Judaism. When I was in Tibet, I encountered monks who kept images of the Dalai Lama hidden beneath the floorboards of their monastery, even though they knew they could be defrocked and banished from the monastery if they were caught. And I began to meet so many people who had made these pretty significant sacrifices to uphold their ancestry, and I realized I had totally walked it away and abandoned my own. That's the subject of my first book, Around the Block, and it was that book I spent all of my 20s working on, and by the end of it, I realized it's time now to reclaim, to learn, to reconnect with this part that's been lost.
Did you write that book with all of that in mind, or was that sort of coming to you as you wrote this book and said, oh, Stephanie?
Yes, it came toward the end. And actually, I think even some editors sort of helped me sort of see that, to kind of pull that out. But that is ultimately where the first book, Around the Block, took me.
And then you moved back home, right, to write that book?
I did, yes, because I quickly realized that, one does not make money in the book business, my friends, especially when you're just starting out. And so my family, I'm incredibly lucky to have wonderfully supportive parents. I moved back home with my mother and my father, and my mother read and edited every single draft of Around the Block. My father bought me a Subway sandwich for lunch every single day and made me dinner. They made it so that I was such a tyrant. I wouldn't let them play the TV too loud. I mean, I was really
I
was in my
home.
Room. I know. And I was dictating everything.
Turn that down.
Terrible.
Wow. But this is not the first time. Now, we're going to get an insight into your character, because I think some of this catharsis is emblematic of your career. Let's take us back to high school, because you were also a yearbook editor, right?
Yes, that's true.
It was around the tyrannical side. Tell us that story.
That didn't go so well.
I mean, it's true that... Yeah. Go ahead, you tell the
story.
Yeah,
my whole staff resigned.
Because you had this idea, right? You were going to do this.
I had a vision. I had a vision, Frank. I wanted this to be the yearbook to end all yearbooks. So all the graduates of Mary Carroll High School in 1992 did not get their yearbook for like 5 months after we graduated.
Because they all quit. To me, it's also emblematic of someone who can actually take on the career as a nomad, because there has to be a certain sense of self, right? And being able to be out there on your own and do this work. Mm-hmm. It's not easy work. You're constantly being reminded of home, perhaps of projects left undone. I'm only guessing that that's happening. And so there has to be a certain singleness of mind, I would think.
Singleness of mind, exactly.
Yeah. So you did that. Then you did write that book, and then you embark on a project which was called The Odyssey. Tell us more about The Odyssey.
Oh,
project.
God. The Odyssey was hands down the greatest year of my life. I get weepy when I think about that year. It was such a remarkable year. So that was a project started by a man named Jeff Golden, who was a public school teacher in San Francisco, who taught English, and all of his students were of Latino descent, and there were Latinos, and knew very little of where they were from. And he was white, but had spent a lot of his life in Venezuela and really traveled around Latin America and wanted to find a way to teach these students' culture to them. And so he left public school teaching. The internet was just a new exciting thing that he was hearing about. And he created this website called The Odyssey. And there were two Odysseys. The first one was called The World Trek, in which he picked, there were six Americans under the age of 30 with laptops and digital cameras, and they ventured out into the world. They traveled to 42 countries in 2 years' time, interviewed the Dalai Lama, interviewed Rigoberta Menchu, I mean, had these incredible adventures. And they made this website that was monitored by several hundred thousand K through 12th grade students about the developing world. They were creating a history of the developing world. I applied for that team while I was writing Around the Block, and I was an alternate for like a year, which meant every couple of weeks, I'd get a call from Jeff, and he'd be like, Stephanie, can you go to Mali next week? I'm like, yes, Jeff, I can go to Mali next week. I'm your woman. Woohoo, let's go. And anyway, then I wouldn't hear from him for like 3 months. Yeah. And then he'd be like, how about Taiwan? You know. Anyway, I never got to go to the World Trek, but I was the first person picked for the U.S. Trek. So that was a team of 10, and we were following Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, and we were rewriting that for a K-12 audience.
Wow.
And
so this is we could call it an alternate history, but is the voices that were not heard,
the voices
that are left out of the American history.
Absolutely. We drove 45,000 miles in 1 year.
Wow.
And the colleagues on that trip were absolutely incredible. I mean, to this day, my very closest group of friends are the people I met on the Odyssey. One I'll just kind of spotlight was Nick Tilson. Nick Tilson is today one of the foremost spokespersons for Native America. He's a Oglala Lakota Sioux from Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. At the time, however, he was 18 and just beginning his own identity trek. And traveling with him was like getting a sort of a PhD master class in Native America today. And we traveled to so many sites with him. I wrote about Wounded Knee. I wrote about the Trail of Tears. So it was incredible to get that perspective. It was also incredible. I mean, he was this passport into nations that would have maybe not been quite as open if I'd been there myself or I'd been there with someone else. But he was like immediate access into Indigenous America. So, yeah, that was an extraordinary year.
You did that, which is that project, and that's what it's meant to do. You also have done reporting for the New York Times. And again, with this kind of this idea that there are untold stories or underrepresented peoples, how do you draw the line, or where do you draw the line between a sense of activism and perhaps commitment, right, to telling a story that's untold, and then this whatever these rules of journalism are, this objectivity?
I think that they can be fused, actually. There was a period of my life where I was working for newspaper journalism. My last job as a newspaper journalist was with the Associated Press. The Associated Press was an incredible experience. I'm so grateful for it. It really taught me immense discipline, taught me about deadlines. I learned so many subjects, but it was also a very difficult way to write. Writing sometimes, I think my record was, I once wrote 4 stories in one day about legislation, Texas legislation. I mean, it was insane. Yeah. And I was just so terrified. I mean, I never even thought about craft. I was just terrified I would have made a mistake. I mean, terrified, like really. And I'm slightly dyslexic with numbers, and it was really a nightmare working for that. And so really quickly, I was like, that's not for me.
I'm going to take a break here and come back and find out what is for you, which is almost everything else. Stephanie Elizondo Greist, award-winning author, professor of creative nonfiction at UNC Chapel Hill. And our conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Stephanie Elizondo Greist. She's a writer who documents the lives along cultural and physical borders. She is one who grew up with living a life along those borders herself. Her new book is called All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands, and a professor of creative nonfiction at UNC Chapel Hill. Talk about a trip to Mexico that you made at the age of 30, and what was the impetus behind that trip?
So at the end of Around the Block, during the promotion of Around the Block, I was continuously being touted as a Latina journalist. And again, I was the tsunami of guilt that had started erupting in high school was swirling all around me. I didn't feel like I had the agency to consider myself a Latina journalist because I still did not speak Spanish. And it just became too much. And so finally, I was like, I've got to do something about this. So I quit my job, put my stuff in storage, which became something I came to do quite often in my life. And I headed off to Mexico. And I was there in 2005, 2006, which was a really powerful time in Mexican history. It was clear that the country was on the brink of something. What I didn't realize was that it was on the brink of an all-out civil war fueled by the drugs, by Americans' overconsumption of drugs. At the time, it seemed like Mexico could really turn a different way, a much more with a happier ending. So while I was there, I spent time with the Zapatistas. I was down in Oaxaca with a people's uprising. I mean, I really did a lot of documentation. And above all, I wrote about undocumented workers and the families they left behind. So that was the subject of my next book, Mexican Enough, My Life Between the Borderlines. And I did, however, quickly come to the realization through this year living in Mexico at age 30, learning Spanish, that even if I were to live the rest of my life in Mexico, I would never be Mexican. Mm-hmm. Why? Because what binds us is childhood memory. What binds us are the bedtime stories. What binds us are the songs, the poems, the prayers, the spells. That's what binds us as a people, I believe. And I did not have that. And what I did, however, have was borderland culture, and I began to think more about it. I'm someone who walks between worlds. That's where I'm from. And so I started having those realizations when I was working on the book Mexican Enough. Continued, however, traveling, became totally nomadic at one point. Actually, in 2006, I became totally nomadic. All my stuff went into storage after Mexico. I put my stuff in storage, and I was completely on the road for 3 years, living at art colonies and living, making money by speaking at colleges and universities and just living on a book tour, essentially, for quite some time. And during that period of time, I would continuously swoop back home. And this homeland that I'd left when I was in high school had suddenly become a major news story, partly as a legacy of the drug war that was brewing in Mexico. Also because Texas had become the foremost crossing ground for undocumented workers, many of whom died. So South Texas essentially became a graveyard. Yeah. And this was happening so close to where I grew up, very close to my parents' family home, and particularly in an area called Brooks County, which is 90 miles north of the border. And it's surrounded by a U.S. checkpoint, a Border Patrol checkpoint, where people, every car has to pass through. And so when coyotes are trafficking humans through this border, they stop about 30 miles short because the Border Patrol has very clear conveyance of about 30 miles radius around this checkpoint, and they walk across it. And this is, I call it a desert jungle in the book. It's sand, it's 120 degrees, it's everything out there will kill you, from the snakes and the scorpions to the cactus, and many do die. And in fact, in 2012 was the deadliest year on record at that point. In one year, they found 129 bodies just in Brooks County. Brooks County is only 900 square miles. And those are the bodies that were found. The vast majority of these bodies, you imagine, are not found. And so in the summer of 2012, they were finding bodies every single day, sometimes more than one a day. And I actually happened to be with the Brooks County sheriff. I was in the sheriff's office interviewing one of the lead investigators when they got in a call. Those calls are called code 500s. So you had actually asked for me to read a selection.
Yeah, if you would, because then you were invited to go along. And I think the sheriff's deputy conveyed some trepidation or suggested that you should have some trepidation, right?
Yes. Yeah. The first thing he asked is whether I had a weak stomach.
Yeah.
It's hard for the stomach not to churn when one is asked that. And I said I would do my best. And so I followed him out on a body recovery. The woman that we found had been out for 3 days. It was, I will now read to you what happened after her body was zipped into a body bag. Over by the ford, Davila wipes his shoes on a patch of huizache. Got to make sure there's no bodily fluid on me, because it'll stink, he explains. We notice the undertaker struggling with the gurney, and Davila hurries over. Together they prop it open, lay the body bag on top, strap it down, lift it up, and roll it into the back of the van. Davila introduces me to the undertaker, whose name is Angel, pronounced Angel, the Tejano way. I want to say, how fitting, and applaud his professional graces. But before I can speak, Davila tells him I am a writer. Angel shakes his head. A lot of people write stories, he says softly. Nothing ever gets done. I hear this a lot, and though it never fails to shatter me, I usually brush it off with a self-deprecating remark and a smile. But there's just something about standing in the woods with a 3 days dead woman in 95-degree heat that gives me the audacity to hope that maybe, just maybe, something will change this time. Congress will change, minds will change, policy will change, and a humane immigration law will finally be enacted. And although that hope vaporizes into idealistic mist before I can even articulate it, there remains a spark of optimism that, by virtue of being written about, this Code 500 might be remembered. That even if we never learn her name, or whether she's Guatemalan or Honduran, or for all we know Chinese, this one member of the 34 who died before her and the 94 who will die after her, this single year in this solitary county of this one state, could be memorialized inside of a story. And at the very least, I will remember her. This woman who hiked illegally through this ranch and got annihilated for it, I will remember what remained of her feet and of her face when I tried to fall asleep at night. Is it wrong, Angel, to pray this counts as something getting done? I wish to say this, all of this, and a great deal more. But there's time only to feebly smile before Angel retreats to his driver's seat, where he removes a pair of badly soiled gloves. He already knows he'll be back tomorrow, and I will not.
Stephanie Elizondo Greist reading from her latest book, All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. It didn't look like they were going to investigate this in any way.
Not remotely. They spent less than half a minute. And because there wasn't a hatchet sticking out of her head or a bullet in her forehead, they declared her cause of death hiking through ranch illegally. That is the official cause of death for all 129 who died, as opposed to immigration policy, as opposed to American consumption of drugs, as opposed to climate change, as opposed to all of the other real reasons why she died. It was declared as hiking through ranch illegally.
You take a look at the border, the U.S. border with Mexico. We're very close to where you grew up, but you also take another border into account, and you document the Mohawks in Akwesasne in U.S.-Canadian border, bordering along the St. Lawrence. Tell us why you decided to compare these two and put the two borders in the same book.
So I was incredibly lucky right after graduating with my MFA from Iowa to be invited to be a visiting professor at St. Lawrence University and arrived there to realize I am 18 miles south of Canada. That's interesting. And then I further recognized that it was the St. Lawrence River Valley. And that rang a bell in my heart because several years earlier, I had been a Hodder Fellow at Princeton University, and John McPhee, the truly tremendous nonfiction writer John McPhee, had come to a realization that he was running out of time to tell all the stories he wanted to tell, to write all the books he wanted to write. And he said, hey, how about I give one to you? And he said, I would, if I were you, write a book comparing the Rio Grande Valley, which is where I'm from, to the St. Lawrence River Valley. At the time, I didn't even know what that was, but I said, great, thanks, John. Filed it away. And then suddenly I realized, oh, my God, I'm here. I am here for a year. And furthermore, I realized that very close by was the Mohawk Nation of Akwesasne, which I had been introduced to by the movie Frozen River, which is quite an astonishing film, if anyone's seen it. And it's about human trafficking along the St. Lawrence River through the Mohawk Nation. It came out in 2008 and was Oscar nominated. It was an amazing film. Anyway, so within a week of arrival, I drove out to Akwesasne to see what I could find. And what I experienced was a pretty radical sense of deja vu. Literally every story that I had uncovered in 6 or 7 years in South Texas, I saw sprawled out in front of me. All the same issues from trafficking of drugs, of people, of guns, to the loss of indigenous language. Mohawks are making a remark. They're very, very, you know, all they are focusing quite intensely on resurrecting Mohawk, but Mohawk really took quite a beating during the 150 years of Indian residential schools, which kind of reminded me of what happened in South Texas when students were forced to take first grade three times here. Students were forced to live in boarding schools where they were not allowed to speak Mohawk, where they had their hair cut, where they were not allowed to practice longhouse traditions. Also, there's a really strong Catholicism undercurrent in the Mohawk Nation, as there is in South Texas. And I realized we are living exactly parallel existences. And that became quite fascinating to me. And then I began to realize all of these ills that I had seen in the border with environmental injustice, with militarization, were not unique to us. Maybe this is a larger condition of what it means to live in the borderlands.
You have the epigraph to your book, or at least to part one of your book. You quote author Gloria Anzaldúa. And talk about that quote. Maybe you can reprise it for us a little bit and tell us why that quote is so important for you and what that means about the kinds of things you're interested in.
The U.S.-Mexican border es una herida abierta where the third world grates against the first and bleeds. And before a scab forms, it hemorrhages again, the lifeblood of two worlds merging to form a third country, a border culture.
What do you make of this open wound that she talks about and describes so graphically, the way in which we now, or at least, you know, we're looking at the President of the United States, who has pardoned a man who has violated the Constitution and the constitutional rights of people across the border. We hear the horrendous conditions that people have to face and the way in which law enforcement treats them. So what do you make of our response to that gaping, you know, that open wound that's between us?
I see a lot of inhumanity, actually.
And for you personally, I wonder, one of the things I want to talk about the title of the book, because I read that All the Agents and Saints actually came from a typo.
It was a typo. I was actually transcribing the Confiteor, which is a prayer that all Catholics know. It's something that's repeated again and again in Mass, All the Angels and Saints. And so I was typing angels, but accidentally wrote agents. I've been looking for a title, Frank, for years and years and years for this book, and a little electric current just sort of shot through my body when I realized this is it.
Here's the thing about the Confiteor. It is a prayer of penitence. It is a penitential prayer, famous for giving us the line, mea culpa. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering why you were typing it out.
Oh, well, I was typing it out. Why was I typing it out? That's a good question. I think just trying to, I straddled many, many borders, and one of them is the border between faith and doubt. Yeah. And so through this book, I was also trying to come to terms with my own sense of Catholicism, what that means. And so this is sort of a bedrock prayer. So I was typing that out. But I typed in agents, and I thought, well, that makes sense, because those are the, you know, for better or for worse, those are the twin protectorates we have at the border. We have the Border Patrol agents on one side, and then we have Catholic saints on the other.
And what does it do for you as you tell these stories, and as you said in that section of the book that you read, maybe by telling the story, someone at least will know who she is. What is it doing for you in terms of helping you understand what it means to navigate these borders? How have you changed since you've embarked on this journey?
Well, I feel like, having always felt this sort of inner fissure inside of me, my goal all along with these stories was to try to somehow fuse. And I do feel that there was a sense of fusion toward the end by seeing that this is in fact what it means to be a resident of the borderlands. And what I see this book as well, this book to me is a testimonio, which is an old form of writing in Latin America. A testimonio, it's an act of bearing witness. I feel so often we only hear about the borderlands from those who make policy decisions from thousands of miles away. We never actually hear about what life is truly like from the residents who live there. I've been in the borderlands. I'm from the borderlands. I spent a lot of time traveling across the borderlines. I don't recall ever meeting a single resident of a borderland who actually wants a piece of architectural violence in the midst of it. No border wall, or in the case of Akwesasne, a border bridge, which serves the same purposes as the wall.
You now live, as you have said before, here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 500 miles from the nearest northern border and about 1,500 miles from the southern border. How do you feel having given up this vagabond life, at least for now?
Well, I still am a bit of a vagabond. I'm very lucky to have a job which encourages adventure in summers and in many breaks. I'm also incredibly lucky that I'm at a university that values creative writing. I'm actually off this semester even, so I'll be traveling all around. Although my first stop is Houston, Texas, so we'll see what happens with those travels. Yes,
Stephanie, what a pleasure. Great to talk with you.
So pleasure.
Stephanie Elizondo Greist is an award-winning writer. Her newest book is All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. Stephanie's going to be reading from her book tomorrow at 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.